Hello, and thanks for joining us. You're listening to the Citation Podcast, made in partnership with our sister brand, Citation Fire and Electrical, with me, your health and safety host, Michael Brown. The week of the 23rd to the 29th of November marks Electrical Safety Week. This aims to promote awareness of electrical safety and, in doing so, raise awareness of the risks of electrical fires, including the simple steps that people can take to avoid the breakout of such a fire. In today's episode, I will be joined by Citation Fire and Electrical's engineering team leaders, Gareth Dixon and Matthew Wellington. We'll be discussing what this week means for employers and the importance of conducting electrical safety checks to keep people and businesses safe. Gareth, Matthew, welcome to the podcast. If you'd like, why not introduce yourselves and just let us know what you do on a sort of day-to-day basis and what your job entails. So Matthew, I'll start with you.
Hi, I'm Matt. I'm team leader south of the company. What that means day-to-day in my job role is looking after the engineers from a technical perspective and giving advice to other personnel within the company.
Fantastic. And Gareth, what about you?
I'm Matt's counterpart in the north, so I do a very similar role, covering fire and electrical, supervising the engineers and giving them technical assistance whilst they're on site.
Fantastic, thank you. Well, to give our listeners a bit of insight as to why we're talking about this and why it's important, there's a few statistics I'd like to go through, and really that's that each year there are over 22,000 fires in UK workplaces, and a quarter of workplace fires are caused by faulty or incorrect use of electrics, and about 9 out of 10 electrical fires are caused by electrical products actually in the place. So it's really key to make sure that these things are maintained and are in good condition. One of the main things that has come into the media lately with regard to electrical safety, and it's probably at the front of people's minds when they sort of think about this, is the case, sadly, of Harvey Tyrrell, a young boy who suffered a fatal shock at a pub in Romford near East London, where he touched some poorly insulated outdoor lights in 2018 and sadly died from this. So one of the things that they're looking at, I believe, is enhancing the electrical safety legislation. But at the moment, that's not quite got through Parliament yet. So what legislation currently governs electricity at work, and what are the requirements behind that, Matthew?
So the law at the moment falls under the Health and Safety at Work Act from 1974, where it stipulates that employers are required to provide and maintain plant and systems that are, as far as reasonably practicable, safe and without risks to health. And so that's the Act, that's law, and you have to try and comply to that law. So from that Act, it gets fleshed out a bit more in the Electricity at Work Regulations 1989. And this is a nice 52-page document where you have to sort of do your utmost to follow those regulations. And then to help further with that, we then have the British Standard 7671, which basically is roughly a 400-page document that then helps the electricians with the inspections that we need to carry out to help keep clients up to code.
It's quite a bit then. In that case, it's not really, you really do need to be quite specialist then in order to sort of understand all of that. I mean, what was it, 400 pages, I think you mentioned one of the codes.
And that's, and that's just one book of many.
Crikey.
But that's the main one, yeah.
Okay, so yeah, quite complex, quite a decent, deep set of regulations then. So Gareth, if I can turn to you then, if I was a customer, you know, faced with all of those, you know, sort of having to get that sort of knowledge and understanding, how would I know whether someone, a contractor, for instance, that I was going to take on, actually understood that? What are there any particular qualifications, or is there any certification that I need to look for, just so I know I'm picking someone really competent to do this?
The most important thing is making sure that you choose someone that's got the right accreditation or certification behind them. So if you go with a contractor that is NIC, EIC or NAPIT, those are the two main ones, they will, as part of their membership with those organisations. Those organisations will do the background checks on the electricians' qualifications, as well as doing regular assessments to ensure that they are keeping up to date and they're complying. So by making sure that you choose someone with that accreditation or certification, they will do all those checks on your behalf.
Okay, that's fantastic then. So really, it's actually just making sure that we've got confirmation that they are currently registered with one of those bodies. Was it NAPIT? And the other one I think you mentioned was...
NICEIC. And you can, if you go to their website direct, you are able to search for someone that has the right accreditation in your area.
That's fantastic. One of the things I used to notice actually quite often on inspections when I'd actually visit more my customers, they'd present a fixed wiring certificate, but it quite often would say domestic, and I'd clearly be in a commercial premises. So really, would it be, you know, by going to one of those websites and actually identifying a competent contractor, would that potentially reduce the risk of getting the wrong inspection done?
Yes, they would be able to let you know whether that contractor's capable for domestic, commercial or industrial.
I suppose that's good, because it means that you're not going to spend money twice on a contractor that actually might not be up to the job. Because unfortunately, every time I found one of those domestic ones, I used to go back and say, either you've got the wrong certificate or you've had someone that hasn't given you the correct inspection, so you need to get it redone anyway. Which was never a comfortable conversation to have. One of the other things quite often I used to get asked would be, is older wiring dangerous? And how do I find out when it was last tested? I mean, Matthew, have you got any clues as to what people might need to look for? Do you just definitely need that certificate or the label on the distribution box?
Yeah, so the gold standard, I'd say, would be to have the old certificate to hand. Because that will show us, one, what is at the site, and two, if there's any remedial works that have been carried out since the inspection, and also any other additional works to the building as well. So we get to see when it was last done, when there was last any works on the building, and that gives us a better chance of understanding your installation. But failing that, you know, we can start from scratch. And if there's just a board on a label, it should have on there when it was last inspected and when it's next due. And that'll give you an indication as to when you should get someone in to have another look at your installation.
That's good to know, actually, because a lot of the time I used to get people sort of say, well, you know, it's every 5 years, I don't have to have it redone. And that's not strictly true anymore, is it? I think actually it depends on the type of installation and where it is. What's the framework around that now? Is it still most premises will be every 5 years, or does it really depend? Is there a bit more nuance now?
So there are recommendations, and some of the recommendations is, say, a commercial premise will be 5 years. An industrial premise will be 3 years. A domestic dwelling, maybe 10 years. Swimming pools, 1 year. But unfortunately, it is down to the engineer's discretion at the time. So if he or she comes to an installation and, you know, it's a commercial premise, but reason has been given to them that it should be brought forward to say 3 years, then they would make that recommendation. And that, you know, that there could be various reasons for that. There could be a high traffic area where there gets a lot, you know, the electrical accessories get abused. There could be a use of a forklift in the back area, back of house type area. And that's sort of what we go on. But there is a rough guidance which can be you can find on the internet.
So really, what you're saying is it really depends on the installation and its use. It's not just a blanket five-year rule.
It's definitely not a blanket 5 years. It is definitely the type and use of building.
And is that similar then with portable appliances? Because quite often I get asked, is portable appliance testing a legal requirement? I mean, Gareth, have you got any thoughts on that? Because quite often I think everyone used to be told, oh, it's every year. But actually, if you look at the Health and Safety Executive's guidelines on that, it's really not as black and white as that, is it?
No. So whenever, in the same way as when an electrician would do a periodic inspection on a building, they'd make a recommendation for when the next inspection should be. It would be the same with the electrical equipment in use as well. They would, whilst they're there, they would do a risk assessment, which would look at the types of equipment in use, the amount of failures, and the environment, and that would deem how frequently the items should be checked. So in a nice sort of clean, tidy office where not much happens, not much gets damaged, it could be as infrequent as 2 years. Whereas if it was a building site or a contractor with tools that sort of get thrown in and out the van, off on and off the site, it would be as frequent as every 3 months. So it completely depends on the environment and the condition of the equipment and how it's been sort of maintained in that interim period as well.
That's interesting, because one of the other questions, and I think in particular since the pandemic, that we keep getting asked quite a bit is, well, I've got work equipment at home. So for instance, right now, not that listeners would know this, but I'm recording this from 300 miles away in my house and you're both in the office. So I'm doing this using a work laptop, which when I first got it, had a pat test. How would that lie then? So would I need to, as an employer, would they need to test my laptop every year, or does it completely depend on how often I'm using it, whether I'm taking it from site to site? How does that work? Because a lot of companies now are doing flexible working where we've got people in the office, people at home. So they're still responsible for the equipment, but how would they prove they've maintained it?
It would be difficult, and it's a grey area that sort of needs filling in more now, because like you say, more people are doing it. From the company's perspective, with PAT testing, it would be, it sort of falls into the area of reasonably practicable. So like you say, if you're 300 miles away, the costs and the convenience of getting that equipment checked and PAT tested, obviously for someone to come to your house and do that, or for you to bring that in, could be extremely expensive. So it's finding a sort of new way around it. So with your laptop, for example, it's not the whole kit that needs to be checked. It's more focused around the lead and the charger. So companies could either come up with that they have a day where everyone gets together for a group meeting or whatever, and then they will get a PAT tester to come along and blitz everything on that day for them. Or it could be that they sent you out a replacement lead, and then the other one gets PAT tested, and they would be able to cycle those leads going around, because usually companies have the same laptops throughout the company for all the employees. So it's coming up with a solution depending on the business, but it is reasonably practicable. So, there may be the odd employee that, because of location, might sort of slip through the crack. But as long as they are making efforts to get as much of the equipment tested and checked as they can, then that's the most important thing.
I think part of that as well is actually the employee has a responsibility to make sure that they look after their equipment. And I think it's reasonable, isn't it, for an employer to say, well, look, here's some instructions on how you visually check this. And it would be fairly basic, I imagine, like, are there any cuts to the cable? Does it get excessively hot? Are there any sort of obvious discolorations or things like that? So I think it's probably a good practice as well for employers to make sure that their employees actually do regularly just do a visual check, even, and preferably record it as well, just so that actually they can be proactive and identify things. I mean, would you recommend something like that as well for employees to sort of be aware of?
Yeah, it's certainly another tool to use to prove that, that you know, they're making sure that the employees are safe. The other one is similar to the manual handling and the data protection courses that we all go through when we start with a company or on an annual basis within a company. That sort of regular annual training could be the same thing with this, with regards to checking that before you use a piece of equipment that it appears to be safe to use.
So it'd be quite a sensible thing then for people to implement in their own companies, sort of a bit of within their perhaps health and safety awareness training when you're talking about fire. So quite early on in the staff process, you know, when you're being inducted, here's your IT equipment, perhaps even when they're issued it, here's your computer. If you're working from home, we expect you once every 3 months or so just to do this visual check and send us back, let us know if there's anything wrong. I think that's probably quite a good proactive step, and hopefully not too onerous as well. But that way, I suppose, between the PAT tests, if you do have someone, for instance, who doesn't always work, perhaps they've got a noisy family and one day they'll be working in one bedroom, the next day they've unplugged it, they're working in another. It could even be that the laptop's permanently plugged in and they've pulled it out by accident and there's potential for damage there. So it's probably worthwhile actually getting people just to visually check that in between each PAT test, like you say. Just to make sure that you're capturing things that aren't that wouldn't otherwise get caught within a year. Join us after the break, where we will be discussing things to look out for from your fixed wiring report and how to remedy them.
To make sure your business is safe from the risk of fire, your employees are safe at work, and you comply with electrical safety standards, Citation Fire and Electrical offers a thorough PAT testing service to businesses nationwide. During your service, our multi-skilled engineer will test all your portable electrical appliances, check all labels are accounted for, and provide you with an in-depth report along with a certificate so you can prove to inspectors that your PAT testing service is up to date and up to scratch. As a BAFE registered business, standards for us are everything. That's why our engineers and assessors undergo routine training and regular audits so we can carry on delivering services that meet those electrical regulations. And if you're conscious about the cost, you'll be glad to know that we base our prices on the amount of equipment we test rather than the size of your business, so you know exactly what you're paying for. So if you want to book in for a PAT testing service with Citation Fire and Electrical, you can get in touch by calling 0800 055 6559.
Welcome back. Before the break, we were talking about the different legislation and accreditations that you need to look out for when you're engaging with a fixed wiring or a portable appliance tester. And we're going to now look at the outcomes of that. So, for instance, when you're looking at the reports, what you need to look out for, what the priorities are, and also a couple of the common sort of queries that we get. The first one that I used to get quite often asked when I was out doing more inspections was, what are the priorities? And if I've got old wiring in the premises, so say I've got wiring from the 1960s, is that dangerous? Matthew, if I can turn to you for that, is old wiring dangerous?
Not necessarily. It completely is determined by the condition of that wiring, and we ascertain the condition of that wiring by carrying out our tests. Where we would look for any defects within your property, and wiring would be one of it. If it's fine, then it won't even make a mention on the report, apart from just a pass.
So yeah, as you've said, it's old wiring isn't necessarily dangerous, but how would I know that as a client? So, Gareth, if I turn to you now, I'm a client, say I've been given a fixed wiring report. What bit of the report do I need to actually look at? Because I've seen a few of these, and some of them run into 20-odd pages, depending on the size of the premises. What do I need to look for on the report? Is there a certain area? And of that area, I think there are certain priorities. How do I interpret them, and how do I know what I need to do?
So in every report, there should be what's called an observations page, which will usually note any of the defects or deviations that are found in the electrical installation. These are all categorised into four main categories. And these are, we have a class one or a C1 code, which is when there is immediate risk or danger to life or property. The best way to describe a C1 would be if you can see past the outer enclosure and into the internals of either a socket or a distribution board or any other electrical accessory within the building. So that would be a C1, and a C1 would always be an item that the engineer should bring to your attention whilst on site. So because it is of immediate risk to life or property. You then have a C2, which is a potentially dangerous. So that's whereby it's not immediate, you know, there is no immediate danger to somebody, but under the right circumstances, it could be dangerous. These observations, usually there's something quite technical or there's something that an electrician or someone that's qualified would recognise as dangerous, but you might not see as being potentially dangerous.
So something that perhaps if unchecked over time as a client, I might not necessarily see. So say if it's a plug socket, maybe there's a very slight hairline crack or something like that, that over time could become a C1. Is that the sort of thing that perhaps might get picked up on, something that you wouldn't notice day to day?
Yes, either something like that, or something that the a device on the board isn't operating as it's supposed to. The equipment would work as we would expect, but if it was faulty, then the safety devices within that installation wouldn't activate in the way that they're supposed to.
Oh goodness, right, okay. So still definitely worth dealing with then.
Yes, so for you to get a satisfactory report, you would have to get that rectified. So you've got the C1, the C2, and then you have an FI, which is further investigation. So that would be something that the inspecting electrician has found that has either given a bad result or is something that he's not been able to fully investigate but has cause for concern. So it might be something that because of the type of business that the electrician's not able to properly investigate it whilst he's on site, but he has raised a concern about that item that requires investigation at either a later date or a shorter, as soon as practically possible. So those are the three most important codes, and having any one of those codes would give you an unsatisfactory report or a failed report that would need repairs or rectification to give you a satisfactory report. And then the last code is a C3, which is something that's not immediately dangerous, but is deviation from the regs. So it's something that might be because the regulations have changed or improved, or something that just, you know, general sort of housekeeping or tidying up or something that's not quite 100% right.
Okay. That's useful to know, actually. So in effect, really, they, as a client, you need to go through and actually, hopefully, you've been told of any code one, so risk to life on the day. And then in effect, you need to sort of work your way through and make sure that you've got someone competent who will then give you, I think you mentioned earlier, an amendment to that report or a follow-up to that report. So say if I've corrected my C1s, I'd expect then to see an addendum to that report saying this is the work I've had done in order to close that off fully. Is that right?
It's not exactly an addendum. It would be you wouldn't need another inspection, but any works that are completed by a competent electrician would be followed by what we call a minor work certificate. So it would be a separate certificate, but it would reference the faults or the fail codes that were on the original inspection.
Fantastic. Okay. So other than the legal ramifications and obviously employers having a duty to, as far as reasonably practicable, look after the well-being and safety of their employees and others that might be affected by their activities, are there any other implications for perhaps not getting the C1s done or not having the report done at all? I think there might be some people thinking, do you know, who might be a bit intimidated or frightened about getting it done because it's been so long and they're a bit worried. Are there any real incentives that mean that there could be real problems if they don't have it done?
It's often one of these little lines that will be hidden in a company's insurance policy that if they don't have an up-to-date electrical installation inspection, that their insurance isn't valid. It's something that you know, one of those tiny little amendments that will be in the policy somewhere that we might not read, that we just sign the document or pay the money every year. But if it's not done, then the insurance could be invalid.
That's really important then. So potentially, without this in place, you could be trading without insurance, which obviously is a huge no-no. And actually, you won't then be covered in the event of something going wrong. So I take it most insurers then would assume in their contracts with you, fixed wiring's in good condition. So if you then had a fire arising from faulty wiring and that wasn't picked up or it wasn't in the report, you're very unlikely to be covered. One other thing, I suppose, that's quite topical and thinking, I suppose, more about PAT testing now. We're about to go into winter. I can think of quite a few offices I used to work in where they'd wheel out these really old fan heaters that always smelled of burning hair when they were first sort of switched on. I think, Matthew, if I turn to you, what are the sort of typical things you see over winter? And do you notice sort of spikes in call outs, things for people wanting things PAT tested in winter? If I was sort of to ask you what's the most typical things that you notice this time of year, what would they be, and where do we help the most?
So yeah, this time of year we do get a lot of extra sort of Christmas custom, I would say. So sometimes we get DJs are very popular this time of year, where they're having to do more functions. They're more likely to come across function rooms that require a certificate to show that they've had their PAT testing done. But around the office, I would say that people, like you're saying, go into that cupboard, they pull out the heater because it's cold. They pull out the old Christmas decorations and they just, you know, most of the time they just sort of plug it in and hope for the best.
What about other sort of environments? So thinking about particularly during COVID times, we're being told to keep ventilation up, open windows, etc. I imagine a lot of venues are probably looking to actually increase the amount of space they can use, perhaps by putting up a temporary structure like a marquee or things like that. Are there any special considerations they might need to think about for a temporary structure such as that?
So using electricals outside is inherently a little bit more dangerous than if you were to use it inside. But the main thing is that you're using equipment that is well maintained and is damaged free, and your staff are adequately trained on it, on how to use it and what defects to look out for. So a lot of the stuff that goes in outside marquees could be, you know, external heaters. Or if you have a gazebo, you might want to put some external lights. So a lot of thought has to be put into how you get the power outside safely. And then also how you then use the plug-in items to use in that outdoor area.
So really, with anything that we're looking at doing outside, documentation-wise, it's really important, I take it, to get someone competent again to do that, or at least take some advice from someone competent as to what you need to do.
Absolutely. You know, you have to make sure that the equipment is PAT tested and is in date, or if it's something that's hardwired into your electrical installation, that it is in good working order.
Well, thank you, Matthew and Gareth, for joining us. And to you, our listeners, thank you for listening to us today. We're coming to the end of the podcast. If you need any additional support on any of the topics we've discussed today, please head over to Citation's Fire and Electrical website at www.citationsafety.co.uk or give the service team a call on 0800 055 6559 and quote podcast. Alternatively, as always, feel free to drop us an email at podcast@citation.co.uk. Thank you and goodbye.